We ought to do this or what?
Heck yeah, we're going to do this or what? This is Doc Mike the Redneck Dentist here on Real Liberty Media Wednesday. It's COVID-free Wednesday, thank God. Maybe. We'll see. I have something to tell you, but yeah, it involves that. So should I do it? I'll just tell you this. Something clicked tonight. This week. Something went off in my brain this week. And it was one of those moments I think happens in life once in a while. And yeah, there was a trigger that I'm not going to talk about because it's COVID-free Wednesday. There was a trigger that happened this week that just was like, for me, it was like, okay, that's it. That's the signal that it's over. It's time to move. Move on. Move to another phase of my life, whatever that is. So, as much as I don't like LinkedIn, I went in and changed my LinkedIn profile a little bit. I immediately got a response, just exactly what I was looking for. I sent an email to the, well, to the one person that I admire the most in the corporation I work in. I have the greatest respect for her. And, just let her know that I was probably not going to finish out the year in this company. In fact, I told her I have no idea how much longer I'm going to stay. So, so my life is looking kind of different. And I don't know what that's going to, I don't really know where it's going to lead. I just know that I can no longer work in this state, voluntarily work in this state. I choose not to, as a healthcare provider, let's say. So in this state, Oregon, the governor has decided, so I'm going to avoid the C word as much as I can. The governor has decided to make mask wearing and vax mandates permanent for healthcare workers. And that was kind of the point for me. It was just like, okay, you're going to make something like that permanent. Well, at least until we try you, put you on trial, and make you pay the price for violating constitutional rights here in Oregon and in the United States. And actually, I kind of thought maybe that was my move. I was kind of thinking, okay, maybe for my next job, I will just take on these big government entities. I don't know if I will or not. But somebody's got to do it. Somebody's got to do something. I don't really want to go somewhere else, but I really don't feel like I have a choice. And I won't have a choice soon if those mandates are made permanent, which they're in session right now. And Oregon doesn't have any, Oregon doesn't have enough Republicans or conservatives or independents to fight anything that the Democrats do in this state, at least not now. So that's looking like it's going to get ugly, and I just choose not to participate in that portion of life here in Oregon anymore. Hey, but I have a great life here. I love doing this podcast. I love being on Real Liberty Media, so those kind of things aren't going to change. We're always going to have the homestead, at least, as long as we can, work the land and maintain the property. We're both pretty healthy for our ages, I think, so, that's a good thing. I don't think either one of us are on chronic medications of any kind. I'm not, and I'm fairly certain Rochelle isn't, or if she is, it's something minor, nothing like life-threatening stuff. But anyway, so kind of a weird change this week, but I'll tell you, it really motivated me to start doing and thinking differently. Like I do this podcast for fun. I think it's fun to do a podcast is what I'm saying. I think it's fun to play with all this audio stuff. I think it's fun sitting right here looking at the screens, watching the meters bounce, knowing that I'm hopefully going to tell you guys, listeners, something that maybe you haven't heard, maybe you haven't considered. Maybe tonight is mostly kind of like nature stuff I have planned to talk about tonight. I think most of it, one thing is kind of commercially, kind of tractor business I'm going to talk about. But anyway, I kind of started putting that in a different perspective. I started thinking, okay, if this is something I'm going to do, even for fun, I need to take it a little more seriously. I need to kind of change maybe some presentation stuff. I need to get committed to writing, actually writing stuff. So I'm going to do a little more of that. And we'll see. I mean, it's just an avenue. I was thinking, it's kind of funny, so I started thinking of all of the stuff I could do other than dentistry. Now, guaranteed, pretty much everything that I could do is not going to make the kind of money I'm making right now. It's insane the amount of money I make right now. And I'm not bragging about that. I worked very hard to get to a point where I can tell people how much they have to pay me to work for them. And that's what I choose to do now. I don't like having a private practice and all the headaches that goes with it. So I usually work for people, but it costs money because I think I'm above average at what I do, and I can do pretty much anything in dentistry, which you can't find docs like that these days, especially the guys coming out of school. The students coming out of school today, they're afraid to do a lot of stuff because they've been indoctrinated about how they're going to be sued, you know, 10 ways to Sunday for doing anything, even doing things right. Still, they're going to be sued. And I just remember that coming out of dental school thinking, well, what the hell, man? We're going to get sued no matter what. And it's terrifying. And I think I talked about it before on a previous episode about having the Board of Dentistry get involved in your everyday life. It's horrible. But, you know, so it limits the new dentist coming out of school because they're afraid to do anything, because they're afraid to hurt anybody, because they're afraid of being sued, and they think their life and career is going to end. But fortunately, that's what you pay malpractice insurance for. So you do the best you can. You try and treat everybody right. And, you know, yeah, sometimes you're going to go through some hassles. But, you know, more than likely, you're going to continue living, practicing, and it's just a little blip on the radar in the end. But anyway, so I was thinking about all the stuff that I could do, and I was thinking, okay, well, yeah, I could do podcasts, but, you know, I'm not going to be on any of the big platforms because, you know, I mean, number one, I'm not going to survive, you know, YouTube because I talk about stuff that they consider controversial. So there's no sense wasting a bunch of time putting my podcast or streams on YouTube because it's just not going to, number one, they'd get flagged, they'd get taken down. Why go through the hassle? I think maybe in the future, you know, one of these other streaming sites, people they're going to become more popular. Not that I'm going to become more popular. I don't really care. I'm not really looking to make money. And that's what I'm trying to get at. At first I started thinking, okay, if I want to practice dentistry, the closest state that I could practice in is Idaho, because Idaho has sensible people in it. And Idaho doesn't have tyrants running the entire state. Although they had their thing, you know, a little bit of tyranny. But for the most part, they, you know, became real reasonable really fast through this whole thing. So, you know, I could go to Idaho. I'd probably work 2 days a week. I drive over, do my 2 days, drive back home, have 5 days here at home. So that was one thing I was thinking of. Then I was thinking, ah, hell, I could work at Lowe's. Lowe's is 13 miles away. I could go. I could get a job there. Hell, everybody's got signs up right now looking for workers. So, you know, I could take a job at some retail place. I could help people find whatever lumber they're looking for, or whatever, you know, plumbing pipes, fixtures, electrical, plants. I don't care. I could do it. I've seen the people who do it. I could do something like that. That wouldn't be a problem at all. I'll tell you what would be a problem, though, is working on that hard concrete floor, man. I did that before at a Costco for some years. And working on concrete floors is very brutal, hard on you, that's for sure. But anyway, and then I started thinking, what the hell? I could just work on the local farms around here. I could go tell people, hey, I'll drive your combine, or I'll help till the fields or whatever. And, you know, I could make a little money that way. What I'm trying to kind of get at, I could basically do anything besides sit at home, although I'm not opposed to sitting at home because there's lots to do around here too. And we could actually turn some of this property into a little, a little bit of profitable property one way or another. I know one thing, we could plant trees, but man, you get the farm deferral for it, but you got to wait a long time to harvest, and, you know, it's kind of a hassle. It's kind of a racket, really. You plant so many trees on your property and pay less tax, but hey, cowboy tech. But yeah, then harvesting the trees, like, what do you do? Grow, like, you know, a couple hundred Christmas trees and then, you know, harvest and sell them, what, every 6 years or something? I guess in 6 years they're 6 feet tall. So somewhere around there. But anyway, the point is, something's going to happen in my life. It's going to be kind of big. And it's okay. I just turned 64. I could retire now. I could retire in 5, 6. It don't matter. You know, it doesn't. None of that matters. Really, being happy, being content, not having some stupid stresses in your life that you have to deal with every day, like freaking mandates of one kind or another, or, you know, having to do something that your corporation thinks that you should do because, you know, they drank the Kool-Aid too. So, yeah, some changes coming. And so I just wanted to kind of get that out of the way. So this is kind of crazy. So at work today, you know, I'm kind of perusing every once in a while, like between patients, I'll pull up my email and see if I got any interesting news stories. And one of the stories that I was reading was how poorly, what is it called now? Meta, Facebook, Meta. How poorly they did, and how this was kind of caught my attention. It said after hours trading, the stock price dropped significantly, and I can't remember if it was 16% or 20% or 13. It was a bunch, and I was like, ha ha ha, Facebook, take that. But I always kind of take, you know, that kind of news with a grain of salt. Because still, it's billions of dollars that Facebook's worth, I guess. Then I get in the car, and I'm coming home from work. It's only 3 miles, so it's little town, so I'm not driving 50. It's like 35, 3 miles. And one of the freaking stories on the local radio was how great Facebook did, except in a couple areas. And I was thinking to myself, hey, wait a minute. That's not the story I read. Now I get my dependable news from independent sources. So I was thinking, where are these guys getting, like, what? How did this story go from what I just read an hour or two ago to you know, how great Meta did. And, you know, then they said, oh, but they didn't meet to some criteria. And, you know, but they never mentioned how the stock price dropped in after hours trading. And I have to wonder what after hours trading is. I mean, is that where, you know, like the Congress people, is that when they trade is after hours? So they can kind of see what the stock already did and then, you know, buy or sell, you know, depending on what the stock market did for the day, so that they are, you know, profit maximally while the rest of us have to stick to, I guess, you know, the normal trading hours. I don't know. I really don't know how all that works. But, I mean, it's another great example of how this freaking mainstream media, you know, spins stories so that most people don't really know what's going on. So, that was kind of an interesting story. God, there was something else locally I heard, but maybe it'll come to me while I'm rattling on about some other stuff. Well, one thing I did want to kind of cover, because it is Groundhog Day, and I kind of got a story from, I think it was Farmer's Almanac, but, you know, like always, everything's going to be in the show notes. So, in the United States, Groundhog Day started on February 2nd, 1887. But I'm going to read you a little bit about the history of the groundhog. It says, Groundhog Day has its roots in the ancient Christian tradition of Candlemas, when clergy would bless and distribute candles needed for winter. The candles represented how long and cold the winter would be. So I guess the clergy were like, oh yeah, six more weeks of winter, here's a bunch of candles. The Germans expanded on this concept by selecting an animal, a hedgehog, as a means of predicting the weather. Once they came to America, German settlers in Pennsylvania continued the tradition, although, of course, they didn't have hedgehogs. They switched from hedgehogs to groundhogs, which were plentiful in the Keystone State. Groundhogs, also called woodchucks, and whose scientific name is Marmota monax, typically weigh 12 to 15 pounds and live 6 to 8 years. They eat vegetables and fruits, whistle when they're frightened or looking for a mate. They're sometimes called whistle pigs, and can climb trees and swim. Something triggered my memory there for a minute, but oh, I remember. I lived in Pennsylvania for a while and saw woodchucks. They're amazing, kind of crazy animals to look at. I know some of you probably live near woodchucks now. I think there's some in, I could have sworn there was some in Minnesota. I think there was some in Minnesota. I'm not 100% sure. You know, some of the places I lived, I only lived for a year or two because basically I was trying to get promoted, and to get promoted you had to take jobs that you had more responsibility for, and those jobs as a dentist always included a bigger staff and a bigger facility. So it had to be bigger than the one I was at, which meant I had to move to wherever. So I moved quite a bit. But, you know, it's paying off now because I get that nice retirement check every month. So that's kind of cool. I know what I was going to say. Well, I know what I was going to say. So, you know, this idea that animals can kind of tell you what kind of weather, like how the winter is going to be, is really not that far-fetched. When I was trapping, you know, I'd trap critters for nuisance, or I would, when I found out that you could still legally trap, like I didn't even know that until about 20 years ago. And I'm kind of an outdoorsman. Like I hunted and fished all my life, but I never know, apparently because I had nobody in my life who was a trapper, I didn't know that you could trap stuff. And, you know, probably, I don't know, you know, we went from those hideous sharp-toothed leg hold traps to, you know, more, I know, I think the word is so stupid, but more humane traps. You know, so I think trapping was kind of like not politically correct for most of my life. And so, you know, you just didn't hear about it much. But when I found out that you could trap stuff, and I think this was in the late 90s. No, it was in the early 2000s. So probably between 2000, I don't know, 3 and 2010 is probably when I trapped. Maybe even later, maybe 12 or 13. But you could actually kind of get a sense of what winter was going to be like by the coats on some of the animals. Like if you have coyotes, like coyotes near where you live, which I'm pretty sure everybody does because they live basically everywhere. If you watch them put on their winter fur, like if you're really observant, like you have time to kind of go to places where you can catch the same animals, see them regularly, you can kind of see. I mean, if they put on a big, thick coat, it's going to be a freaking cold winter. And I don't know if they actually get it wrong. Like, I don't know if, like if they start growing their winter coat and then something kind of triggers and their coat just, you know, kind of mellows out until the next cold snap, and then boom, they put some more fur on. But I'm telling you, even raccoon fur in the wintertime, they are so bushy and soft, beautiful coat. Skunks actually have a winter coat, and I know this is crazy, but skunk, that stark black and white, I think is one of the most beautiful pelts you can get. And I know probably a lot of you are thinking, yeah, but here's the deal. You can take care of skunk smell so easily. I'm going to tell you. So get your pen and get your pen and paper. This is important because I don't care if you've tried every other old wives' tale in the book for getting rid of skunk scent. I'm going to tell you how to get rid of skunk scent, and this works 100% of the time and will remove 99% of the scent, and sometimes 100%. If you repeat it once or twice, you won't smell skunk at all. Now, I'm going to tell you this because we actually have a skunk kit. Because if you live in the country, you're going to run across a skunk once in a while. And definitely your dogs are going to run across a skunk once in a while. So this is the kit we have. It's a 5 gallon bucket with a lid. In that bucket, on the bottom, is a couple rags, like old dish towels or old hand towels, or I have told this before. Anyway, so you put the hand towels in the bottom. You get a big container of hydrogen peroxide. And some stores, you can get pretty big containers. I'm not talking, I mean, 16 ounces good, but you want like a quart of hydrogen peroxide. You want a big bag of Arm & Hammer baking soda, and you want Dawn dish soap, just regular Dawn dish soap. So when an animal gets hit with a skunk, we literally, well, as soon as we get them away from the skunk and usually kill the skunk, we immediately grab the kit because if you've ever had an animal get hit by a skunk before, they start, your dog, cat, whatever, will start frothing at the mouth. They're shaking their head, sneezing. I mean, it's horrible to watch. And so you want to get that stuff off of them as fast as possible. But you also don't want them to come running to you, which they do, especially when you fire around at a skunk and, you know, your dogs react to that. They'll come running back to you. But anyway, so we grab the bucket, we put a little bit of water in it, and I mean like a quart, maybe maybe a quart to half a gallon of water in the bucket. I mean, we take everything out of the bucket first. Put a quart to half a gallon of water in the bucket. You pour the entire hydrogen peroxide in the bucket. You grab a handful of Arm & Hammer baking soda, throw it in the bucket. You grab one of those, and then you put a squirt of Dawn dish soap over the top of all that. You grab one of those rags, you dunk it down there in the water, get it soaking wet, stir it all up. You know, make sure it's well stirred up so everything's mixed good. You pull that rag out, you barely wring it out, and you take it to your dog and start wiping their face off. And you can imagine, you can do this in seconds, literally. Like in less than a minute, you're going to give your dog some relief. Anyway, and that's the secret, man. That's it. So if you live in an area where you have skunks, skunk problems, dog and skunk encounters, keep that in mind. That is the greatest way to handle it. So when I would trap skunks, and most of the time, this is, you know, skunks like to get into chicken coops for whatever reason. They get in there and they'll destroy eggs. They might even kill a chicken. So people would call me and want me to come and, you know, get the skunk out of their coop, which the skunk's never in the coop. It's always gone by the time I get there. But then I would trap them, and, you know, to deal with that, you know, I wanted, when I trapped, well, not in the summertime so much, most of those critters would go to waste because they go to waste. That's the problem. They're nuisance. But if I would catch them in the wintertime when that coat is so thick and beautiful, I would harvest the pelt and process it so that I could keep it. And they were beautiful. Skunk was just striking, beautiful pelt. And pretty easy to get off the skunk too, by the way. I don't know why I think that's funny, but I do. So I think animals can tell you, you know, if it's going to be a pretty strong winter, but I think you have to be really observant. And also, you know, I don't know, like I don't have any science to back it up. I'm just saying from personal observation. Yeah. Oh, you know, the other thing is like I watch the squirrels and the scrub jays. Like you see them burying a ton of nuts. Like they do it every year anyway. But you could almost tell what kind of winter it's going to be. I mean, if those two animals are also correct in their predictions, you know, if you see them like really raping the walnut tree and burying nuts all over the place, and the scrub jays, they'll take hazelnuts or filberts. I don't know what you guys call them where you're from. They'll take those and they'll take peanuts and they'll take pine nuts and just bury them, you know. And when you see them, like especially before a big storm's coming, you watch real closely. They are after it, man, like crazy. Oh, we're going to take a little break. I'll be back in a minute. All right. Good time to move on, I guess. All right. Hey, I wanted to tell you guys this, this kind of interesting article I read. So I started subscribing to a rag paper called the Capital Press, which is actually kind of good because it talks about like agricultural stuff and what's going on in farming and just ag business. But also you can find some good deals there on farm equipment, or you can find estate sales that are selling farm equipment and stuff like that. And in the current, it comes out once a week. So in the current issue, they were talking about the autonomous John Deere tractor. And I thought, well, that's kind of interesting. I mean, the first thing I thought, for some reason I had this vision of a circus elephant that has escaped and just was tearing up the world. I don't know why. Maybe like a transformer thing or something. I was just thinking, oh, great. So this tractor's going to drive itself and, you know, harvest fields and whatever. So, but after that, I started thinking, okay, well, let's look at this and see, you know, what is this about? Because it sounds interesting to me. And actually, one of the podcasters I've been following lately, I think her podcast is Laura Farms. Her name's Laura, and she farms. I mean, she's on a big farm in Nebraska, I think. Her family's been farming for a long time. Now, she's a college kid, graduated, I think. But, you know, she chooses to farm and podcast about it. And I've actually seen her or her family running these machines, and they have these, I mean, Jesus, you look at these machines now, they have so much, like, electronics in them, you know, so much, like, GPS and data collection and processing as you're driving the frickin' tractor. Like, they have multiple screens in there. Some are active computers, and some are just cameras that, yeah, maybe so, right? Some of the screens are actual computers, and some of them are just cameras, so you can see different things, like behind you, or see in the hopper, or see the blades, or whatever. Whatever you want to watch, you can watch. And I actually, like, there's been times when I thought she said that they had to set the GPS, and then the tractor would just do what it's doing. So, I mean, it would just go harvest, you know, but you had to be in it. Anyway, so these tractors, no, you just drive them to the field, and there's some setup process at first, probably so the tractor can learn the field or position itself on GPS or I don't know what. And then it just goes and does whatever. It'll plant the seeds. It'll, you know, till the soil. It'll make the rows. It'll harvest. It'll do whatever you tell it to do. I mean, it's kind of like a giant robot. But then what I thought was interesting, I actually about a week ago was reading this story because there's currently a kind of a little hassle going on with John Deere and the right to repair your own equipment, because farmers have been, you know, using tractors for hundreds of years, and think about before that when they were using horsepower and, you know, implements. I mean, they repaired their own stuff all the time. But apparently John Deere doesn't want farmers to repair certain parts of their equipment because, you know, John Deere doesn't want any interference with their software. Like, they don't want people manipulating their software, which this doesn't make much sense to me. It only makes sense in the corporate world where, you know, you protect your intellectual rights. That's exactly right, Rob Works. They don't want to give up the keys. And, you know, farmers forever have... farmers don't have time to wait for, you know, their tractor to go to the shop and, you know, have somebody fix it and then bring it back to them. I mean, sometimes certain crops, you're lucky if you can get the humidity at plant level at the perfect humidity to harvest that day or in that time frame. Like, you know, if a storm comes and changes the humidity, you're screwed. If the crop dries out too much, you're screwed. And there's a lot of crops that you have to get them just right. So you don't have time to call John Deere. I mean, imagine, you're out in the middle of Iowa on thousands of acres, and your tractor takes a dump. And it's go time. It's like, hey, we got to harvest this corn today. Because it's not going to, you know, storm's coming in tomorrow. It's going to be here for several days, you know, whatever. We need to get this corn done today. You don't have time to wait for you know, John Deere to come out and get to fix a tractor or send a tech out or take your tractor in. You don't have time. You have got, you know, farmers have a pretty slim margin of profitability. So you got to do things right. Which is kind of like, I kind of get the idea of having this kind of data collection on the tractors to see what kind of yield you're getting as you're harvesting. And then each year, each field, each kind of situation, you can evaluate how your, you know, how your own practices are doing. And if a certain field is getting burned out, or one field or one method that you use is really producing well, or whatever. I mean, you can use live data on, you know, live data and just the data being collected. You can kind of review it and see how all your fields are doing, how all your equipment is doing, if you got, you know, pure crop or if you got a bunch of crap in your hopper, whatever. But then I started thinking about all, like, who else, first let me finish this idea. You don't have time to wait for John Deere to come and fix your tractor. You should be able to fix your tractor and get back to work. That's the bottom line. That's how American farmers, probably farmers all over the world, have always done it. Yeah, 6 weeks. And I mean, that's how they want to do it. I think most farmers, yeah, they want to limit cost, you know, which I could imagine. So just think, I don't know how many people this tractor is going to replace, because you don't have to have somebody sitting there driving it. Like, you know, and farmers work hard. Sometimes they work, you know, 12, 16, 18 hours. I don't know. But if they want to not work that hard, they'll hire somebody to drive the dang tractor part of the time. I mean, there's guys here in the Valley, Yamhill Valley here in Oregon, who are always looking for somebody to go drive the combines and, you know, help harvest. And because they don't want to sit in a damn tractor 24/7. You know, they got to get some sleep. Anyway, so I imagine that tractor is going to be pretty damn expensive, number one. And how many people is it going to really replace? I mean, that you don't have to have a driver sitting in there. I mean, that is kind of cool, because you can be out doing something else while your tractor's working away. Still kind of a scary idea, but that's cool. But I started thinking, so John Deere obviously isn't going to keep that data isolated from others, if you know what I mean. Because John Deere, of course, is going to want to show the world how, you know, all the purchasers, how great their equipment is. And if they have proprietary software, well, you can't really look in there and see how they're using, you know, how they're using the data. And then I started thinking, okay, so who's going to be getting that data? And why? Or who could get access to that data and why? Because as far as I know, I mean, who knows? Maybe that data is sent by Wi-Fi or cell phone service. Who knows? Sent to John Deere. And who else could be picking up? So let's say this. What if you were, let's say you were an investor who wanted to buy up farmland. And you wanted to know, you wanted to buy the best farmland. So you could tap into this data. Let's just say you could tap into this data. Maybe it's not that simple. Maybe somebody just gives you the data. So let's say you're kind of looking for some farmland. And you see that so-and-so has 100,000 acres, and it is excellent farmland. It's the highest producing farmland you can buy. Well, let's say you had enough resources to devalue that farmland in some way. Whatever way. Like, maybe you have access to aerial sprayers. Maybe you have access to drones. Maybe you have access to people that will go in and screw things up or poison the land or, you know, introduce other copyrighted produce or seed into your crop so that you can't, you know, actually harvest the crop and sell it because Monsanto's got their, you know, fingers in it. Or maybe you just want to see, let's say, you know, environmental groups would be interested in how much fuel is being used, like, well, or how many chemicals are being sprayed, you know, so that they could step in and say how, you know, well, we have to stop, you know, we have to have tractors spend less time in the field during this certain time of the year because they contribute so much to air pollution. Now, I'm not saying John Deere would do that, but if John Deere is feeding that data to other entities, you know, things, you know, not that, it's not like people don't know how food is grown and how it's processed in this country. Yeah, it takes a lot of fuel to do it. A lot of diesel fuel, too. But I could see that there's a lot of opportunity for, you know, nefarious entities to screw with farmers. I don't know if it's a really good idea. And actually, you know, you can't help it because John Deere is John Deere, and they're going to keep hold of their, you know, they're going to hold on to that technology as long as they can. But you really would hope that something like, you know, your tractor's software would be open source so that you could have somebody kind of come in and screw with it, kind of alter it so it worked best for you, and maybe you could tighten up the security so your data isn't being shared with whomever in the world. But yeah, I could see some really ugly things happening with that. And apparently, you know, there's some people who are just dying to get these trackers. Which, you know, you kind of can't blame them. It'd be, you know, wouldn't it be nice if you, instead of working for 16, 18 hours, you know, this June or August, you just go, hey, I'm gonna go put the tractor to work. I'll be back in 30 minutes for breakfast. That would be kind of cool. But you know what? I mean, there's always a price to pay. And you know that people are just going to be using this data for whatever reason. And you know it's not going to be, I know it's not going to be secure. I just see it as, I think it's a great idea for the farmers. I really think that that's a great idea to free up some of their profit, like they don't have to spend it on workers, but I mean they're going to spend it on this machine anyway, so you got to figure, well, what's the profit margin between having, you know, guys drive the tractors and buying this expensive tractor? And then on top of that, you know, what's going to happen with this data, and who am I going to have to answer to? It kind of reminds me of the freaking smart thermostats. Do you guys remember this? I don't know if any of you have them. I don't. But they were actually, like in California, they actually were installing these thermostats, smart thermostats, right, that the government controlled because, you know, they don't want you using your air conditioner when it's 110 outside. I know this doesn't make sense, but You know, they didn't want you using your heater when it's 20 degrees, which doesn't happen often in California, but you know what I'm saying. So they would limit, like they controlled your thermostat because they have a power problem, because they don't want hydroelectric dams. They don't want coal, you know, fired power plants. They only want wind turbines and solar. You know, no nukes, for God's sakes. Can't have a nuclear power plant. So, you know, they have, you know, they have power limitations. So they don't want you using power, especially when you need it. Especially when you're sweating your balls off and you want to cool down and you can't because they control the temperature. Anyway, that's what I'm kind of getting at with this whole, you know, computer-driven, autonomous tractor. It kind of looks like nothing's wrong with hydro, I don't think. But, you know, in California, Rob, they don't want anything. Hydro kills fish, and they have that stupid salmon. They have that stupid fish that lives in a couple of the rivers, but especially the Sacramento River. And I can't remember if it's a salmon or if it's a smelt. It was imported. It's a non-native species, and they protected it for whatever freaking California reason you can think of. And so they can't have hydroelectric dams because they are protecting this invasive species that they somehow adopted as their own stupid project to save. Oh, don't get me started. Well, you already did. Anyway, yeah, exactly. I'm not saying that on the radio, but yeah, exactly. Okay, so that's my John Deere thing. Let me just kind of review my notes. I didn't even look at them. I thought I kind of had an idea what I wanted to say about that. But let's just see. Yeah. Oh. Yeah, I mean, I do have some kind of interesting stories, but we took up almost an hour. That's good. Let's go on to something else. Oh, yeah, I thought this was kind of interesting. So SpaceX launched a rocket 7 years ago in 2015. The crewless Falcon 9 rocket launched by Elon Musk's space exploration company in 2015. They launched this rocket to put a satellite in orbit. They put the satellite in orbit, but the rocket engine malfunctioned, and it's kind of stuck in this orbit, but it's free-falling toward the moon, and it's going to hit the it's going to hit the moon next month in March. Well, they're pretty damn sure it's going to hit the moon next month. And I was thinking to myself, well, it's not rocket science, but it is actually rocket science. And how do you play rocket scientist and accidentally crash your frickin' launching engine into the moon? I mean, that's if you think back to the space race of the late 50s and early 60s, you know, they made it sound like it was really hard to hit the moon. And here Elon Musk can do it by accident. I for some reason, I think that's pretty funny. But let's see. Yeah, so that'll be interesting. I wonder if it'll... Yeah, that's right. That's right, Moose Girl. Water gets pumped into California. And, you know, the sad thing is they got their water restricted so much this year because Oregon and other states that contribute to California had such droughts that they couldn't send enough water to California to water the crops in the Northern California. So there's going to be a shortage of, you know, foods that Northern California supplies to the rest of the country because the droughts, no water. And they actually, I think it was the first time that California actually said, like, they didn't even have enough water to keep that stupid fish alive. It was like, that was their panic. Which, honest to God, like, I don't know how these people could possibly think like this. But that stupid, invasive, imported fish outranks food production. How does that ever happen? Like, how insane is it to save a fish that isn't even native to your state over producing food to feed people and animals? And you know, one of my sayings is 95% of every species that's ever lived no longer exists. Took that from my biology, my BA, my Bachelor of Arts in Biology from University of Oregon. One of the few things I remember, besides that stall guy and his whole virus gene insertion thing. That was crazy. Yeah, anyway. Crazy world we're living in. Well, yeah, it's Wednesday. Oh, Bear had to go get his teeth cleaned today. He is home now, and everybody's kind of here. It's dinner time. I'm going to go eat something. I hope you guys enjoyed the C-Free show tonight. So you guys have a great time. I will see you on Saturday. Thanks for listening to Doc Mike and the Redneck Dentist here on Real Liberty Media. See you guys on Saturday.